Hello, everyone, and welcome to CBA's At the Bar, a podcast where we have unscripted conversations with our guests about legal news topics, stories, and whatever else strikes our fancy. I'm your host, John Amarillo of Taft Law, and I'm joined today by a former colleague of mine, now retired, Carrie Donham. Lawyers often have interesting life paths that led them to the law, but Carrie's story, his journey, is among the most unique I've ever come across. We're going to get into some of the details here today with him, but this is the gist. To this day, Carrie is the only West Point cadet to claim conscientious objector status. It's such an odd thing to say, almost a contradiction in terms, a cadet at America's premier military academy standing up and saying that he doesn't believe in war. We're going to talk about that with Carrie. We're going to talk about his newly released autobiography, A Wrinkle in the Long Gray Line, When Conscience and Convention Collide. And since this is a legal podcast, we're going to discuss the court battle that Carrie fought to gain recognition from the Army as a conscientious objector. But first, let's say hello. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, John. Good to see you.
It's good to see you too, my friend. Your book, thank you for sending it over. I really enjoyed reading it. It's a fascinating case study, I think, of a moral dilemma in a legal context. But before we get into that, I thought maybe we could start at the beginning. Tell me and the audience something about where and how you grew up, because I think that informs this discussion quite a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I grew up in Southern Illinois, oldest of four children, born in 1949. My dad was a school teacher. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. If you know anything about Southern Illinois, Southern Illinois is more like the Deep South than Northern Illinois, north of I-80.
And my wife's from there. It's more Kentucky than Chicago.
Oh, yeah, way more. In some ways, it seems like it's more Mississippi even than Kentucky, now that I live in Kentucky.
Fair enough. Was religion a big part of your upbringing? Because I know that has a big role to play in what we're talking about here today.
Yeah. My mom, in particular, was very religious. She grew up in a fundamentalist Baptist family in southern Indiana, one of eight kids. So we always went to church. You know, I was very active, went to Sunday school, became the president of the local Methodist Youth Fellowship while I was there.
Yeah, I'm getting a flavor for it. So you grew up in an environment like that, you know, conservative's not the right word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, but I did take the church seriously in terms of what the teachings were.
Okay. So you did well in high school, obviously, because you went to West Point.
Yeah, I did well in high school.
Did you have relatives who served in the military?
My father. My father was a pilot in World War II. He was a captain. He won the Air Medal, served in the Philippines and Australia and New Guinea. And I should say New Baden is only 9 miles from Scott Air Force Base, which back in the 60s was one of the largest Air Force bases in the country.
Okay. So a bit of a military town.
It was a military town. My parents were all for me going to West Point.
Why did you select West Point?
I might have chosen the Air Force Academy, but my eyes weren't good enough. I mean, you had to have 20/20 vision to even get your foot in the door to go to Air Force Academy. West Point was a little more forgiving about eyesight.
But not about academic rigor. I mean,
West Point
is the premier military institute in the country.
Yeah, it's still considered, at the time I wrote the book, number 18 or so, best college in the country. Well, of course, that was U.S. News and World Report. Take that with a grain of salt. But still, it was a very, very good school.
But eyesight aside, why a military academy? Why not University of Illinois?
A couple reasons. One, I was always worried about money. My dad's salary as a school teacher wasn't very much. I was the oldest of four. And you go to West Point, it's basically free. Mm-hmm. So that was one concern. And then this was in 1967. When you got out of high school, you had to deal with the draft.
Right.
That was just a big, big consideration. This was before the lottery. So you're either going to get a deferment.
Which college kids got in 1967. You could go to any college. It didn't have to be West Point, obviously.
Until you finished college.
Right.
Yeah, let's see. Divinity students got a deferment. People who worked in agriculture got a deferment. There was a conscientious objector. But ultimately, you were going to be facing the draft. My thought was, if I go to West Point, I'll end up an officer. I thought that was a better way to use my talents. And just be cutting to the chase. I'd be following in my dad's footsteps, being an officer.
So at that point, you're a 17-year-old kid. You're going to West Point. Obviously, you've had this religious upbringing, but you weren't thinking to yourself anything like, I don't believe in war. I don't believe in justified killing, right?
No, that was not something that I thought about at all.
So when did you start having those thoughts?
The thoughts really started, let me put it this way. When I went through Beast Barracks, which are the 8 weeks summer before your plebe year starts, your first West Point year, we had to do the bayonet drill where you had to yell that the spirit of the bayonet is to kill, sir. And that was kind of like, oh, that's not what I was expecting. But I said, well, but we're all doing it, so okay. Where it really hit me, though, was during the summer before my junior year, I was a squad leader. I was in charge of 11 young new cadets who were just facing West Point the first summer. And my job was to help them, both teach them how to survive in West Point, mm-hmm. and teach them discipline and so on. Well, one of my jobs, as all squad leaders' jobs were, was to teach bayonet drill. Mm-hmm. So I would be up on a stand in a field way down close to the Hudson River, away from the rest of the campus, with a rifle with a bayonet fixed on it. And I would go through the different bayonet moves with these 11 new cadets in front of me. And one of the things that was part of the training was to ask being, I mean, like yell, what's the spirit of the bayonet, men? And the answer is, to kill, sir. I didn't hear you. That wasn't loud enough. What's the spirit of the bayonet? To kill, sir. And as I went through that, I started to think, I'm not all that comfortable with this, but I did it.
Sure.
But that was where things really started to make me think about, what am I doing?
Let's break that down a little bit, because I thought you did a good job describing it in your book, A Wrinkle in the Long Gray Line. But I had trouble understanding it, because this is West Point.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out soldiers, famous soldiers, U.S. Grant, pretty much every Civil War general you've ever heard of, Eisenhower, pretty much every World War II general you've ever heard of. Mm-hmm. I mean, the purpose of this institution is to turn out army leaders. Mm-hmm. And, you know, being in the military obviously involves killing. So how I couldn't quite understand how it took you. And, I don't mean this as a dig. I'm genuinely asking how it took you 3 years to realize that, you know, the purpose of West Point was to train people to kill.
You know, that's a really good question. When you're at West Point, your time is just taken up. You don't have time to think about philosophical questions. Your goal is to make it to the next day, mm-hmm. make it to the end of the semester, make it to the end of plebe year. Then you're at Camp Buckner doing the training, and there's a certain excitement to Camp Buckner, I will say, because you're firing artillery, you're driving tanks, you're going out in the woods on fake patrols.
What 18-year-old kid wouldn't love to do that, right?
you're learning to rappel down a 60-foot cliff, things like that. I mean, it's very demanding. And then the academics, my sophomore year, I had like 21 credit hours a semester with advanced physics, advanced chemistry, advanced calculus, parades during the week. So there really isn't time to think about the grander philosophy of what you're doing there. You're just trying to make it to the next day. Meanwhile, you're going to chapel. Chapel was mandatory while I was there. It was mandatory until 1972. The chaplains, who were very good, but, you know, you would hear things like, well, as a soldier, you have no greater responsibility than to take someone's life. So there was just something that happened during the bayonet drill that just really made me, it started me thinking, which is not what you're really encouraged to do while you're there.
Did you realize that at the time, or are you saying this in retrospect? Like, when you were doing that bayonet drill, did you have some sort of revelation in the moment that you recognized as such? Or decades later, are you looking back and identifying that moment as the moment things changed for you?
No, at the time, it was the first time I had really felt uncomfortable with something that was going on there. And then things kind of progressed. Later that summer, I learned that one of my high school classmates, and there were only 30 boys in my high school class, had been killed in Vietnam. Someone who was one of the poorest kids in the school, who used to ride his bicycle around town delivering newspapers, had been killed barely a year after he graduated from high school. And then around that time, the word came out about the My Lai massacre. Not only that, but the general who was the superintendent at the time had been involved in covering it up. Then that fall of 1969 was when the demonstrations on college campuses started to get bigger. A group of women from Vassar came to West Point on the moratorium day. And I was watching them from my room at the parade when the band played the national anthem. They didn't stand up. And I was like physically shocked at that. It's like, how could these people not even stand up during the national anthem?
Was it that you were questioning the U.S.'s involvement in Vietnam, or that you were questioning war generally?
I was questioning war generally. It was that what's one thing that all wars have in common? Young people are sent out to do battles for old men, and it's still the case today.
I'm trying to nail this down a little bit so I understand it. So you're having these thoughts, these realizations, and how do you come to identify yourself as someone who's a conscientious objector rather than just someone who is having abstract ideas about the morality of war?
Okay. At the time, I had a girlfriend who ended up becoming my first wife briefly. So she was having me, there were books that she was having me read, like Siddhartha. And that started me thinking along that life is like a river and that everyone is part of it. And how can you go out and consciously destroy part of what you are? You know, you're part of that river of life, so to speak. Then I got some, and it was always the Bible, turn the other cheek. Who's your neighbor? Anyone who you fed or you clothed, they're your neighbor. And love your neighbor as yourself. It doesn't say love your white neighbor or your American neighbor. I mean, those were what was going through. And then I've got a couple of books that had essays by people who had actually professed to being conscientious objectors or pacifists. Mm-hmm. And I was reading those books and experiences that people had. And I was talking to my parents about it. I have the letters that I quote a lot from in the book that I was writing home. And I was having discussions with my parents about war and should I continue at West Point and so on. So that was important. I was having conversations with Diane, my girlfriend. Then eventually I got the name of a draft counselor. And I called the draft counselor who put me in touch with some lawyers in New York City who they said would be interested in talking to you.
And this was Joan, forgetting her name, forgive me.
Joan Goldberg.
Thank you.
And the other guy was Marvin Karpatkin, who was with the ACLU.
So what does that process look like? You declare yourself, you just walk into your commanding officer's office and say, I'm a conscientious objector, count me out?
The process, and I was stunned to learn this, the Army had a regulation, Army Regulation 635-20, I don't think I'll ever forget that number, that laid out how one in the service can apply for conscientious objector status while in the service. Mm-hmm. So it was a long process then, first to decide that I was going to do this. Mm-hmm. I think I first contacted the draft counselor in February, and I didn't actually get a chance to go on leave on a Saturday and meet Joan Goldberg until April 22nd, I think it was, of 1970.
When you did this, were you trying to make a larger statement, or was this just about you and your own personal beliefs?
At the time, this was personal. I wasn't really trying to be a national figure or anything like that. I was just dealing with how I was feeling at the time, and I didn't want to be put in a position where I would be forced to kill someone.
So the Army rejected your application to be recognized as a conscientious objector, right?
Yes, they did. They did. It was a, part of the process is I had to get this typed. It turned out to be pretty long. I mean, 9-10 pages. I had to get reference letters. Diane typed it. She was going to college right next to West Point. So we meet on weekends and she'd bring me what she had typed and I'd give her stuff. And, you know, we were trying to collect these letters like from professors and other people we knew, my pastor back in New Baden. And as it happened, I finished this. It was all ready to go pretty much the same day or the day after exams had ended for the spring semester. My class was getting ready to go on a tour of Army bases, and I did not want to go on that tour. So I walked into the officer in charge of our cadet company and handed him the paper and said, sir, I'm applying for discharge from the Army as a conscientious objector.
How did the Army react?
Major Baker just like was kind of bewildered. He just said, well, okay, I guess I'll have to look at this. The Army was definitely not pleased. Mm-hmm. They had to follow certain rules. So I had to have an interview with a psychiatrist, which West Point arranged, who said, yeah, I was sane and that my reasoning was cogent. Then I had to get a statement from a pastor and a chaplain, Mike Easterling, who I had been meeting with during this time and talking with, a really fabulous pastor. And he's also a in the Wheaton College Hall of Fame as a soccer goaltender. So he wrote a statement supporting me. Then the Army had to find an officer who was familiar with the rules about conscientious objectors to do an interview. And that was Colonel Gleason. Mm-hmm. And we arranged it. It had to be when my lawyer could come up and sit in on the interview. And he didn't believe me. It was clear going in that he did not believe that a West Point cadet could possibly have come to the conclusion that he couldn't kill someone. I mean, and I suppose that's not totally unreasonable, but the Army was not going to have a West Point cadet get discharged as a conscientious objector, especially, I think, in 1970 and during the Vietnam War with Nixon as president. So he had my application. I didn't. He was asking me questions about it. He would get things wrong. I'd try to correct him, and he wrote that I was wrong when he wrote a report. But I did make a huge mistake in answering a question, something that has stayed with me, and it was also something that I really always remembered when I was preparing witnesses as a lawyer later. He said, when did you decide to become a conscientious objector? And I said, oh, when my exams were done. But then he said, but you've decided to become a conscientious objector in February. I said, no, that was when I first contacted a draft counselor. But that statement went in that I wanted to finish the semester. That was my main motivation, was to finish the semester, then apply. And that showed that I was not sincere. And that stayed with me through all the appeals and so on. That was...
Right, because the whole purpose of this process is to test the interview with the pastor, the psychiatrist, and the lieutenant colonel was to test whether your beliefs were sincerely held, right? So your credibility is the central issue.
Absolutely. And my lawyer recognized immediately that that was bad. So we took a break and we came back in, and she asked me a couple of questions, and I tried to, you know, rehabilitate what I had said, but that made no impression. The way that I know that is that we have Gleason's recommendation, which he wrote about 2 days after the interview and sent it up the chain of command. My lawyer took notes, and she wrote a very detailed letter with her notes of the whole interview. But that was after everything, that Gleason's recommendation had already gone up, and the Army, I got a memo through FOIA that the Army had sent down saying, we don't want Donham to submit any kind of rebuttal. So you could say that this was fixed.
Which leads us to the court battle, which we will pick up right after this commercial break. We'll be right back.
Getting legal malpractice insurance doesn't have to be complicated. Let CBA Insurance Agency do the heavy lifting for you. We shop to the top carriers to find the best rates. Get a free quote by visiting cbainsurance.org.
Seeking to expand your legal network, sharpen your skills, and obtain free CLE? Unless you plan on being a professional failure, that's probably a good idea. Join the Chicago Bar Association today and connect with lawyers and judges who lead Chicago's legal community. The CBA will help you expand your personal and professional networks while providing practical programs and resources that meet your specific practice needs. New lawyer membership starts at just $82 a year. Learn more at www.chicagobar.org.
And we're back. So, Carrie, we left off with the Army rejecting your status as a conscientious objector, calling your credibility into question. So what do you do next? You sue, right?
Yeah, that's what we did. The form of the lawsuit, it was a habeas corpus lawsuit. Right. My lawyer explained, well, habeas corpus means you have the body.
Yeah, produce the body. Yeah, you usually associate it with prisoners.
You do. But anyway, that was the form of the lawsuit that Joan filed in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York.
So how did it go in the district court, the trial court?
Well, not well. The judge, it was a good judge. The judge was named Marvin Frankel. Mm-hmm. He wrote an opinion that said that all that he could do was determine if the Army had a basis in fact for rejecting my application.
Right.
And he said, if this were up to me in the first instance, I might come out differently. But on the record, the Army had a basis to question Mr. Donham's sincerity. Mm-hmm. And so I have to affirm what the Army did and deny the habeas corpus application.
In that sense, it sounds like a pretty standard administrative review case, right?
In a sense, yes, it was, although the issues are considerably right. different than most
right.
administrative reviews. But yeah, and the decision is reported, and I include a copy of it as an appendix to yep. my book. It's a well-written decision.
So you take it up on appeal to the Second Circuit, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. What was your argument there?
Well, let me interject because there's a little more that goes on before then.
Sure.
In the meantime, I had been ordered to active duty, and I was ordered to report to Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And the question was whether, do I go? Do I refuse to go? Do I just leave and go to Canada? Mm-hmm. So I reported, and I met the captain who was in charge of the unit that I was going to be temporarily assigned to. And he said, look, I don't want any trouble here. I know your background. I'll assign you to work with a chaplain. You don't have to carry a gun. Can we work together on this? So I called Joan, and she said, if that's what his deal is, then I would take it. The Court of Appeals will not like it if they find out that you've been offered this, and in the meantime, and you just thumbed your nose at it. Mm-hmm. And I offer that because I think that was very good advice, and I followed it. So the oral argument was set, I want to say, beginning of December, and in the meantime, I had gotten married before I went to Fort Campbell, and I got leave for 3 days because I also had orders then to report from Fort Campbell to Fort Sam Houston in Texas to undergo medic training, which I thought was ironic because they said I wasn't a conscientious objector, but then they were going to make me a medic, which was kind of like one of the options for conscientious objectors. But
right.
meanwhile, so I went to New York and was in the courtroom when Joan argued the case. The main argument, I believe, and there was a couple, was that the rules said that the hearing officer needed to be knowledgeable about conscientious objector rules and so on.
Right.
And argument was he wasn't at all familiar. He thought that conscientious objector status had to be based on religious grounds.
Mm-hmm. Which wasn't the case at that point. It had been previously, but was no longer at that point in time.
Many, many years ago, yeah. His questions were biased. I mean, they weren't intended to learn. They were intended to put me in a corner. Mm-hmm. And had the hearing officer come down on my side, it would have been very difficult for the Army to have rejected my application after the psychiatrist and the chaplain also said that I was sincere.
Right.
So what I remember was at the end of the oral argument, Joan said, you know, Mr. Donham's been ordered to go to Fort Sam Houston in the next couple of days. They ask that your honors stay that order. I thought it was just a shot in the dark, you know. And they, right. But they, from the bench, they granted that.
From the bench?
They granted that from the bench.
That never happens in appeals. That never happens. That's not how it works. So that's pretty extraordinary in and of itself.
Yeah. So I was on leave again, back living in New York, worked at Gimbel's department store over the Christmas holiday. I mean, I was really basically in limbo at this point. Then first week of January, this is also extraordinary. They issued the ruling that reversed the Army and remanded the matter to the Army to hold another hearing.
Right. Applying the right standards.
Applying the right standards with a hearing officer who is knowledgeable. Imagine getting a written opinion from the Seventh Circuit in 30 days or so from oral argument.
No comment. No comment. I still have to argue in front of them.
Yeah, I've argued in front of them, and yeah, no, that's not, it's not my experience.
So, you know, I know we touched on this before, but the thing that really stands out to me is, like we said, the circumstances were extraordinary, but the arguments made here and the issues that were before the district court and then the Second Circuit, these are very run-of-the-mill administrative review law questions. Were the proper standards applied? If not, then remand for a new hearing in front of a different hearing officer. I mean, it's all sort of bread and butter administrative review law, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is when you drill down just to the legal issues.
Right. So it went back for a new hearing and you won.
Yeah, well, even that was complicated. First, I had resigned from West Point.
Right.
And now I'm on leave from the Army. And I get a job as a gopher for a law firm in New York that does Broadway productions. Mm-hmm. Great job at the time. Meanwhile, the Army is writing letters. The general counsel of the Army wrote a letter to John Mitchell, who was the Attorney General at the time, yeah, telling him, why aren't we appealing this to the Supreme Court? And why is Donham still on leave? He should be like any other person. He should have be on some kind of restricted duty.
Kind of flattering to have that level of attention.
Well, you know, it was interesting to find that out through my Freedom of Information request. So it wasn't until like May that the Army got around to ordering a new hearing. And the hearing officer this time, and it was at a place called, I think, Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn. And it couldn't have been, you know, more different than night and day. It was Major Don Moore. And we had the hearing. It was straightforward. And I never heard what he said. And I did, in August, get a message to report to Fort Dix in New Jersey to be discharged. And it wasn't a conscientious objector discharge, but it was an honorable discharge. Mm-hmm. So one day, much, much later, I get a phone call, and it is from Don Moore. And I learn, and I've had some communications with him, that he had written a recommendation that I be discharged as a CO. He was ordered to change it. He said, that's an illegal order. I'm not going to change it. He said, well, the highest office in the land is interested in your changing that. Well, I'm not going to do it. It ruined his career. He ended up resigning from the Army and joined the Army Reserve. He had envelopes that were steamed open. And I've never found that his recommendation, the Army never produced it in the FOIA responses, which that's one of the more interesting things about my whole story, I think, is how it not only affected me, but it affected the career of a really a fine officer who was just doing his job.
If we can, I'd like to fast forward a bit just because we're running low on time, Carrie. I know there's a lot more there to explore, and you know, readers can certainly do it in the book, which I'd encourage them to do. But did this whole experience make you want to become a lawyer? I mean, this was every level of the law here.
Eventually, yes. It took me a while to get there. Mm-hmm. I've been interested in the law, I mean, while I was at West Point. Mm-hmm. And it did show me that there is some power to the law for good, and that things can be achieved through litigation. Now, it took me another 14 years before I started law school. That experience and reading practically every Perry Mason book, those were my big influences.
I've heard a few lawyers of your generation say that about Perry Mason. Let me ask you one last question before we go to Stranger and Legal Fiction. Looking back all these decades later, would you have done this any differently?
No.
You still would have gone to West Point?
Yeah, I would have gone to West Point. I mean, West Point was, you know, at the time, it was like, if you're competitive and you're from a small town and you have a chance to do something that no one in your small town has done, yeah, I would have done it. In the circumstances, knowing that it was a chance to become an officer, follow where my dad had done, you know, who knew anything about Vietnam, about what was really going on in Vietnam in 1967. So yes, I would have done it. And I also would have applied for discharge from the Army as a CO. I wouldn't done any different.
We'll be right back with Stranger and Legal Fiction.
Interested in getting more calls from potential clients? Consider joining the CBA's Lawyer Referral Service. The LRS has provided a valuable service to attorneys in the community for over 80 years by matching clients with attorneys in particular areas of law. The LRS receives 25,000 calls annually and makes over 10,000 referrals to attorneys each year. In the last 2 years alone, LRS attorneys have been referred several cases that have settled for an excess of $1 million. To learn more, visit www.lrs.chicagobar.org. Are you looking to get away to someplace warm and sunny this winter? Join the Chicago Bar Association's CLE Abroad in Mexico. We're headed to Mexico City from March 24th to March 26th with an optional extension trip to beautiful San Miguel Allende from the 27th to the 29th. The trip will include CLE programming for attorneys, as well as tours, cultural experiences, and networking opportunities. Attorneys and their guests are welcome to attend. To learn more and register, visit chicagobar.org/Mexico 2024. We hope to see you there.
And we're back with Stranger and Legal Fiction. Our audience knows the rules. They're pretty simple. I've done some research, found a real law that's out there, but probably shouldn't be real. I've made another one up, and I'm going to quiz Carrie to see if he can distinguish strange fact from fiction. Carrie, you ready to play?
I am.
All right. So I'm going to give you two options. Tell me which one's real and which one's fake. Option number one. In 1910, Congress passed the so-called Hippo Bill, authorizing the mass importation of hippopotamuses, hippopotami, say hippopotamuses, to Louisiana to help both clear land of unwanted flora and provide a ready source of local affordable meat. Option number one, importing hippos to Louisiana. Option two, in Alabama, it is a misdemeanor to appear in a public place dressed as a member of the clergy if you are, in fact, not an ordained member of the clergy, which is real.
I'm going to go with the hippos.
Why?
Something tells me that I might have read something about that. And I don't know, that's just my gut. I know Louisiana's got a lot of swamps to drain. And anyway, that's my guess.
Fair enough. I'd say you were close. The Alabama law is the real one. Shout out to my dad, Joseph Amarillo, for sending me the Hippo Law. That was a House bill backed by none other than Teddy Roosevelt, but it never actually became law. It didn't pass. The Alabama law is real. Alabama Criminal Code Section 13A.14.4, for anyone who wants to look it up. And if you dress as, I suppose this is a problem around Halloween time, but if you dress up as a priest, you could be fined up to $500 and confined in a county jail for a time not to exceed 1 year. So be careful around Halloween, folks.
Yeah.
Carrie, I want to thank you for joining us today. This was an interesting conversation. I really enjoyed it. And I wish you the best of luck with the book, which again is A Wrinkle in the Long Gray Line When Conscience and Convention Collided, available from all fine booksellers. I also want to thank our executive producer, Jen Byrne, Adam Lockwood on sound, and everyone at the Legal Talk Network family. Remember, you can follow us and send us comments, questions, episode ideas, or just troll us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at CBA at the bar, all one word. You can also email us at podcast@chicagobar.org. Please also rate and leave us your feedback on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, Audible, or wherever you download your podcasts. It helps us get the word out. Until next time, for everyone here at the CBA, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you soon at the bar.